flowed like water at the party, and there were already men leaning on old Hector's mausoleum, glaze-eyed and slack-jawed. He caught a glimpse of someone behind the thing, too, having a piss in the shrubbery. He shook his head. There'd be a body under every bush by nightfall. Christ! One thought of bodies under bushes, and his mind had presented him with a blindingly indecent vision of Claire, lying sprawled and laughing under one, breasts falling out of her gown, and the dead leaves and dry grass the same colours as her rumpled skirts, and the curly brown hair between her... He choked the thought off abruptly, bowing cordially to old Mrs. Alderdice, the judge's mother. "Your servant, ma'am." "Good day to you, young man. Good day." The old lady nodded magisterially and passed by, leaning on the arm of her companion, a long-suffering young woman who gave Jamie a faint smile in response to his salute.
"Master Jamie?"
One of the maids hovered beside him, holding out a tray of cups. He took one, smiling his thanks, and drank half its contents in a gulp. He couldn't help it. He had to turn and look after Claire. He caught no more than a glimpse of the top of her head among the crowd on the terrace. She wouldn't wear a proper cap, of course, the stubborn wee bism, but had some foolishness pinned on instead, a scrap of lace caught up with a cluster of ribbons and rose hips. That made him want to laugh too, and he turned back toward the willows, smiling to himself. It was seeing her in the new gown that did it. It had been months since he'd seen her dressed like a lady, narrow-waisted in silk, and her white breasts round and sweet as winter pears in the low neck of her gown. It was as though she were suddenly a different woman, one intimately familiar, and yet still excitingly strange. His fingers twitched, remembering that one rebel lock spiralling free down her neck, and the feel of her slender nape, and the feel of her plump, warm arse through her skirts pressed against his leg. He hadn't had her in more than a week, what with the press of people round them, and was feeling the lack acutely. Ever since she had shown him the sperms, he had been uncomfortably aware of the crowded conditions that must now and then obtain in his balls, an impression made forcibly stronger in situations such as this. He kent well enough that there was no danger of rupture or explosion, and yet he couldn't help but think of all the shoving going on. Being trapped in a seething mass of others with no hope of escape was one of his own personal visions of hell, and he paused for a moment outside the screen of willow trees to administer a brief squeeze of reassurance which he hoped might calm the riot for a bit. He'd see Duncan safely married, he decided, and then the man must see to his own affairs. Come nightfall, and if he could do no better than a bush, then a bush it would have to be. He pushed aside a swath of willow branches, ducking to go through. "Duncan," he began, and then stopped, the swirl of carnal thoughts disappearing like water down a sewer. The scarlet coat belonged not to Duncan Innes, but to a stranger who turned toward him with surprise equal to his own, a man in the uniform of His Majesty's army. The look of momentary startlement faded from the man's face almost as quickly as Jamie's own surprise. This must be MacDonald, the half-pay soldier Farquhar Campbell had mentioned to him. Evidently Farquhar had described him to MacDonald as well. He could see the man had put a name to him. MacDonald held a cup of punch as well. The slaves had been busy. He drained the cup deliberately, then set it down on the stone bench, wiping his lips on the back of his hand. "Colonel Fraser, I presume?" "Major MacDonald," he replied, with a nod that mingled courtesy with wariness. "Your servant, sir." MacDonald bowed, punctilious. "Colonel, if I might command a moment of your time." He glanced over Jamie's shoulder. There were giggles on the riverbank behind them, and the excited small screams of very young women pursued by very young men. "In private?" Jamie noted the usage of his militia title with a sour amusement, but nodded briefly and discarded his own cup, still half full, alongside the Major's. He tilted his head toward the house in inquiry. MacDonald nodded and followed him out of the willows as loud rustlings and squealings announced the bench and its sheltering trees had now become the province of the younger element. "He wished them good luck with it, privately noting the location for his own possible use after dark. The day was cold, but still and bright, and a number of guests, mostly men who found the civilized atmosphere within too suffocating for their tastes, were clustered in argumentative groups in the corners of the terrace, or strolling round the paths of the newly sprouting garden, where their tobacco pipes might fume in peace. Assessing the latter venue as the best means of avoiding interruption, Jamie led the Major toward the brick-lined path that curved toward the stables. "Have you seen Wiley's Frisians?" the Major asked as they rounded the house, making casual conversation till they should be safely out of earshot.
"Aye, I have. The stallion's a fine animal, is he not?"
By reflex, Jamie's eyes turned toward the paddock by the barn. The stallion was browsing, nibbling at the weeds by the trough, while the two mares head and tailed it companionably near the stable, broad backs shining in the pale sun.
"Aye, well, perhaps."
The Major squinted toward the paddock, one eye half shut in dubious agreement.
"Sound enough, I dare say. Good chest. All that hair, though. Wouldn't do in a cavalry horse, though, I suppose, if it were properly shaved and dressed."
Jamie suppressed the urge to ask whether MacDonald liked his women shaved as well. The image of the loosened curls spiralling down that bare white neck was still in his mind. Perhaps the stables might afford a better opportunity. He pushed that thought aside for later reference.
"You had some matter with which you were concerned, Major?" he asked,
more abruptly than he'd meant to.
"Not so much my own concern," MacDonald replied equably. "I had been told that you have some interest in the whereabouts of a gentleman named Stephen Bonnet. Am I reliably informed, sir?"
He felt the name like a blow to the chest. It took his wind for a moment. Without conscious thought, his left hand curled over the hilt of his dirk.
Yes. You know his whereabouts?" "Unfortunately, no." MacDonald's brow lifted, seeing his response. "I ken where he has been, though." "A wicked lad, our Stephen, or so I gather," he inquired with a hint of jocularity. "You might say so. He has killed men, robbed me, and raped my daughter," Jamie said bluntly.
The Major drew breath, face darkening in sudden understanding.
"Ah, I see," he said softly.
He lifted his hand briefly as though to touch Jamie's arm, but let it fall to his side. He walked a few steps further, brows puckered in concentration.
"I see,"
he said again, all hint of amusement gone from his voice.
"I hadn't realised..." "Yes, I see."
He lapsed into silence once again, his steps slowing as they neared the paddock.
"I trust you do intend to tell me what you know of the man," Jamie said politely.
MacDonald glanced up at him and appeared to recognise that regardless of his intentions, Jamie's own intent was to gain what knowledge he had, whether by conversation or more direct methods.
"I have not met the man myself," MacDonald said mildly. "What I know I learnt in the course of a social evening in New Bern last month."
It was an evening of whist tables hosted by Davis Howell, a wealthy shipowner and a member of the Governor's Royal Council. The party, small but select, had begun with an excellent supper, then moved on to cards and conversation, well marinated with rum punch and brandy. As the hour grew late and the smoke of cigarillos heavy in the air, the conversation grew unguarded, and there were jocular references to the recent improvement in one Mr. Butler's fortunes, with much half-veiled speculation as to the source of his new riches. One gentleman, expressing envy, was heard to say,
"If one could have but a Stephen Bonnet in one's pocket,"
before being elbowed into silence by a friend whose discretion was not quite so much dissolved in rum.
"Was Mr. Butler among those present at this soiree?" Jamie asked sharply.
The name was unfamiliar, but if Butler was known to members of the Royal Council... Well, the circles of power in the colony were small. Someone in them would be known to his aunt or to Farquhar Campbell.
"No, I wasn't."
They had reached the paddock. MacDonald rested his folded arms atop the rail, eyes fixed on the stallion. "He resides, I believe, in Edentown." As did Philip Wiley. The stallion, Lucas, that was his name, sidled toward them, soft black nostrils flaring in curiosity. Jamie stretched out his knuckles mechanically, and, the horse proving amiable, rubbed the sleek jawline. Beautiful as the Frisian was, he scarcely noticed it, his thoughts spinning like a whirligig. Edenton lay on the Albemarle Sound, easily accessible by boat. Likely, then, that Bonnet had returned to his sailor's trade, and with it, piracy and smuggling.
"You called Bonnet a wicked lad," he said, turning to MacDonald. "Why?"
"Much of a hand at whist, Colonel Fraser."
MacDonald glanced at him inquiringly.
"I recommend it particularly.
It shares some advantage with chess, in terms of discovering the mind of one's opponent, and the greater advantage in that it can be played against a greater number."
The hard-bitten lines of his face relaxed momentarily in a faint smile.
"And the still greater advantage that it is possible to earn a living by it, which is seldom the case with chess." "I am familiar with the game, sir,"
Jamie returned with extreme dryness. MacDonald was a half-pay officer, with neither official duties nor an active regiment. It was by no means unusual for such men to eke out their meagre salary by the acquisition of small bits of intelligence, which might be sold or traded. No price was being asked now, but that didn't mean that the debt wouldn't be called in later. Jamie gave a brief nod in acknowledgement of the situation, and MacDonald nodded in turn, satisfied. He would say what he wanted, in good time.
"Well, sir, I was, as you might suppose, intrigued to learn who this Bonnet might be, and if he were indeed a golden egg, which goose's ass he'd dropped out of."
MacDonald's companions had regained their caution, though, and he could learn nothing further of the mysterious Bonnet, save the effect he had on those who had met him.
"You'll ken that often enough you learn as much from what men don't say as what they do, or from how they say it."
Without waiting for Jamie's nod, he went on.
"There were 8 of us at play. 3 were making free with their speculations, but I could see they kent nae more of Mr. Bonnet than I did myself. 2 more seemed neither to know nor to care. But the last 2...
He shook his head.
"They became very quiet, sir, like those who will not speak of the devil for fear of summoning him."
MacDonald's eyes were bright with speculation.
"You are familiar with the fellow Bonnet yourself?"
"I am." "The 2 gentlemen who knew him?"
"Walter Priestley and Hosea Wright," MacDonald responded promptly.
"Both particular friends of the governor. Merchants,
among other things. Both have warehouses. Wright in Edenton and Plymouth. Priestley in Charleston, Savannah, Wilmington and Edenton. Priestley has business concerns in Boston as well," MacDonald added as an afterthought, "though I know little of their nature. Oh, and Wright's a banker."
Jamie nodded. His hands were folded together beneath the tails of his coat as he walked. No one could see how tightly his fingers clenched.
"I believe I have heard of Mr. Wright," he said. "Philip Wiley mentioned that a gentleman of that name owns a plantation near his own."
MacDonald nodded in affirmation. The end of his nose had gone quite red, and small broken blood vessels stood out in his cheeks, mementos of years spent campaigning.
"Aye, that would be 4 chimneys."
He glanced sidewise at Jamie, tongue probing a back tooth as he thought.
"You mean to kill him, then?"
"Of course not,"
Jamie replied evenly. "A man so well connected with those in high places."
MacDonald looked at him sharply, then away with a brief snort.
"Aye, just so."
They paced side by side for several moments without speech, each occupied with his private calculations, and each aware of the others. The news of Bonnet's associations cut both ways. On the one hand, it would likely make the man easier to find. On the other, those associations would complicate matters quite a bit when it came to the killing. It wouldn't stop Jamie, and MacDonald clearly perceived that. But it was a matter for thought, to be sure. MacDonald himself was a considerable complication. Bonnet's business associates would be interested to hear that someone meant to cut off their source of profit, and would be more than likely to take action to prevent it. They would also pay well for the news that their golden goose was threatened, a prospect MacDonald would naturally appreciate. There was no immediate way of corking up MacDonald, though. Jamie lacked the means for bribery, and that was a poor recourse in any case, as a man who could be bought once was always for sale. He glanced at MacDonald, who met his eye, smiled slightly, then turned his head away. No, intimidation wouldn't serve, even had he a mind to threaten one who'd done him a service. What then? He could scarcely knock MacDonald on the head, only to prevent his spilling to Wright, Priestley, or Butler. Well, and if it couldn't be bribery or force, the only thing left to stop the man's mouth was blackmail, which presented its own complications insofar as he knew nothing, for the moment, to MacDonald's discredit. A man who lived as the Major did almost certainly had weak spots. But finding them? How much time might he have? That thought triggered another. "How did you hear that I sought news of Stephen Bonnet?" he demanded abruptly, breaking in on MacDonald's own contemplations. MacDonald shrugged and settled his hat and wig more firmly.
"I heard it from a half dozen different sources, sir, in places from taverns to magistrates' courts. Your interest is well known, I fear. But not," he added delicately, with a sideways glance, "its reason."
Jamie grunted, deep in his throat. It seemed he had no knife but with a single edge. Casting a wide net had brought him his fish, but without doubt it had also caused ripples that might warn away the whale. If the whole coast knew he sought Bonnet, then so did Bonnet. Perhaps this was a bad thing, or perhaps it was not. If Brianna were to hear of it, she had been outspoken in her desire that he leave Bonnet to his own fate. That was nonsense, of course, but he hadn't argued with her, only listened with every appearance of consideration. She need know nothing until the man was safely dead, after all. If an unwary word were to reach her before that, though... He had only begun to turn the possibilities over in his mind when MacDonald spoke again.
"Your daughter? That would be Mrs. Mackenzie, would it? Does that matter?"
He spoke coldly, and MacDonald's lips tightened briefly.
"No, to be sure. 'Twas only... I had some conversation of Mrs. Mackenzie and found her most charming. The thought of..."
He broke off, clearing his throat.
"I have a daughter myself,"
he said abruptly, stopping and turning to face Jamie.
"Aye?"
Jamie hadn't heard that MacDonald was married.
Quite possibly he wasn't. "That would be in Scotland?"
"In England. Her mother's English." The chill had painted streaks of colour on the soldier's weathered skin. They deepened, but MacDonald's pale blue eyes stayed steady on Jamie's, the same colour as the hazy sky behind him. Jamie felt the tightness down his backbone ease. He lifted his shoulders in a shrug and let them fall. MacDonald nodded, infinitesimally. The two men turned, without discussion, and started back toward the house, conversing casually of the price of indigo, the latest news from Massachusetts, and the surprising clemency of the weather for the season.
"I had spoken with your wife a little earlier," MacDonald remarked. "A charming woman, and most amiable. You are a fortunate man, sir." "I am inclined to think so,"
Jamie replied, darting a glance at MacDonald. The soldier coughed delicately.
"Mrs. Fraser was so kind as to suggest that you might consider providing me with a letter of introduction to His Excellency the Governor. In light of the recent threat of conflict,
She thought that perhaps a man of my experience might be able to provide something in the way of... You see?
Jamie saw fine, and while he doubted that Claire had suggested any such thing, he was relieved to find the price asked so cheap.
"It shall be done at once," he assured MacDonald. "See me after the wedding this afternoon, and I shall have it in hand for you."
MacDonald inclined his head, looking gratified. As they reached the path that led to the necessary houses, MacDonald nodded farewell and took his leave with a raised hand, passing by Duncan Innes, who was coming from that direction, looking drawn and haggard as a man will whose bowels are tied in sheepshank knots.
"Are you well, Duncan?" Jamie asked,
eyeing his friend with some concern. Despite the coolness of the day, a faint sheen of sweat shone on Innes's brow, and his cheeks were pale. Jamie hoped that if it were an ague, it wasn't catching.
"No," Innes said, in answer to his question. "No, I'm... MacDo, I must speak to you." "Of course, Sacharich."
Alarmed by the man's appearance, he took hold of Duncan's arm to support him.
"Shall I fetch my wife to you? Do you need a wee dram?"
From the smell of him, he'd had several already, but nothing out of the ordinary for a bridegroom. He didn't appear to be the worse for drink, but was plainly the worse for something. Perhaps a bad muscle at last night's supper. Innes shook his head. He swallowed and grimaced as though something hard was stuck in his throat. He drew air through his nose then, and set his shoulders, steeling himself to something.
"No, MacDo, it's yourself I am needing. A bit of counsel, if you might be so kind." "Aye, Duncan, surely."
More curious than alarmed now, he let go of Duncan's arm.
"What is it, man?" About the wedding night," Duncan blurted. I have...
He broke off abruptly, seeing someone turning into the path before them, heading for the necessary.
"This way."
Jamie turned toward the kitchen gardens, which were safely enclosed in sheltering brick walls.
"Wedding night,"
he thought, both reassured and curious. Duncan hadn't been married before, he knew, and when they were in Ardsmuir together, Duncan had never spoken of women as some men did. He had thought it only a modest constraint at the time, but perhaps...
But no, Duncan was well past 50. Surely the opportunity had occurred.
That left buggery, or the clap, he thought,
and he'd swear Duncan had no taste for boys. A bit awkward, to be sure, but he had full faith that Claire could deal with it. He did hope it was only drip, and not the French disease, though. That was a cruel plague. "Here, Aharich," he said, drawing Duncan after him into the shelter of the onion beds. "We'll be quite private here. Now then, what's your trouble?"
Chapter 40. Duncan's Secret. Father Leclerc spoke no English, with the exception of a jolly tally-ho, which he used alternately as a greeting, an interjection of amazement, and an exclamation of approbation. Jocasta was still at her toilette, so I introduced the priest to Ulysses, then escorted him to the main parlour, saw him provided with suitable refreshment, and sat him down to make conversation with the Sherstons, who were Protestant, and rather bug-eyed at meeting a Jesuit, but so eager to show off their French that they were willing to overlook Father Leclerc's unfortunate profession. Mentally wiping my brow after this bit of delicate social rapprochement, I made my excuses and went out to the terrace to see whether Jamie had succeeded in retrieving Duncan. Neither man was in sight, but I met Brianna coming up from the lawn with Jemmy. "Hello, darling, how are you?" I reached for Jemmy, who seemed restless, squirming and smacking his lips, like someone sitting down to a six-course meal after a trek through the Sahara. "Hungry, are we?" "Ha!" he said. Then, feeling this perhaps an insufficient explanation, repeated the syllable several times with increasing volume, bouncing up and down by way of emphasis. "He's hungry. I'm about to explode," Brianna said, lowering her voice and plucking gingerly at her bosom. I'm just going to take him upstairs and feed him. Auntie Jocasta said we could use her room.
Oh, that's good.
Jocasta's just gone up herself, to rest a bit and change, she said. The wedding's set for 4 o'clock now the priest is here. I had just heard the case clock in the hall chime noon. I did hope Jamie had got Duncan safely in hand. Perhaps he should be shut up somewhere to prevent his wandering away again. Bree reached to take Jemmy back, sticking a prophylactic knuckle in his mouth to muffle his remarks.
"Do you know the Sherstons?" she asked.
"Yes," I replied warily. "Why, what have they done?" She raised one eyebrow at me. "They've asked me to paint a portrait of Mrs. Sherston. A commission, I mean. Evidently Auntie Jocasta sang my praises to them and showed them some of the things I did when I stayed here last spring, and now they want a picture."
"Really?"
"Oh, darling, that's marvellous." "Well, it will be if they have any money," she said practically. "What do you think?" It was a good question. Fine clothes and appointments didn't always reflect actual worth, and I didn't know much about the Sherstons' circumstances. They were from Hillsborough, not Cross Creek.
"Well, they're rather vulgar," I said dubiously,
"and dreadful snobs. But I think he's legitimately rich. He owns a brewery, I think. But ask Jocasta, she'll know for sure."
"Rather vulgar,"
she drawled, mocking my own accent, and grinned. "Who's a snob, then?"
"I am not a snob," I said with dignity. "I am a keen observer of social nuance. Have you seen your father and Duncan anywhere?"
"Not Duncan, but Dar's down there by the trees with Mr. Campbell." She pointed helpfully, and I spotted Jamie's bright hair and crimson tartan, a fiery gleam at the bottom of the lawn. "Not a sign of Duncan's scarlet coat, though."
"Damn the man," I said. "Where has he got to?"
"Went to the necessary and fell in," Bree suggested.
"All right, hold your horses, we're going."
Addressing this last to Jemmy, who was uttering plaintive cries suggestive of imminent starvation, she disappeared into the house. I settled my shawl and strolled down the lawn to join Jamie. A picnic lunch was being served to accommodate the guests, and I snatched a biscuit and a slice of ham as I passed the refreshment tables, improvising a hasty snack in order to stave off my own hunger pangs. The air was still cool, but the sun was high and hot on my shoulders. It was a relief to join the men in the shade of a small grove of oaks that stood near the bottom of the lawn. They were pin oaks and had begun to leaf out already, the unfolding leaves peeping out like a baby's fingers.
"What did Nyawenny tell me about oaks?"
"Oh, yes. One planted corn when the oak leaves were the size of a squirrel's ear. Judging by that, the slaves could be planting corn in the river-run kitchen garden any day now. It would be weeks before the oak leaves were out on the ridge, though." Jamie had evidently just said something humorous, for Campbell made the low creaking noise that passed with him for laughter, nodding to me in greeting.
"I shall leave you to the practice of your own affairs, then," he said to Jamie, recovering his composure. "Call upon me, though, at need."
He shaded his eyes, looking up toward the terrace.
"Ah, the prodigal returns. In shillings, sir, or bottles of brandy?"
I turned to look as well, in time to see Duncan crossing the terrace, nodding and smiling shyly to well-wishers as he passed. I must have looked bewildered, for Mr. Campbell bowed to me, dry mouth crooked with amusement.
"I'd laid your husband a small wager, ma'am."
5-1 on Duncan the night," Jamie explained. "That he and my aunt will share a bed, I mean."
"Goodness," I said rather crossly. "Is anyone here talking of anything else? Mind's like sewers, the lot of you."
Campbell laughed, then turned aside, distracted by the urgencies of a small grandson.
"Don't tell me you weren't a-wondering the same thing," Jamie nudged me gently.
"Indeed I was not," I said primly.
I wasn't, but only because I already knew.
"Oh, indeed,"
he said, one corner of his mouth curling up.
"And you with lechery as plain on your face as whiskers on a cat."
"Whatever do you mean by that?" I demanded.
Just in case he was right, I flicked the fan open and covered the lower half of my face.
I peered over its ivory lacework, batting my eyelashes in mock innocence. He made a derisive Scottish noise in his throat. Then, with a quick glance round, he bent low and whispered in my ear.
"It means you look as you do when you want me to come to your bed."
A warm breath stirred the hair over my ear.
"Do you?"
I smiled brilliantly at Mr. Campbell, who was viewing us with interest over his grandson's head, snapped the fan open, and, using it as a shield, stood on tiptoe to whisper in Jamie's ear. I dropped back on my heels and smiled demurely at him, fanning away for all I was worth. Jamie looked mildly shocked, but definitely pleased. He glanced at Mr. Campbell, who had fortunately turned away, drawn into conversation elsewhere. Jamie rubbed his nose and regarded me with intense speculation, his dark blue gaze lingering on the scalloped neckline of my new gown. I fluttered the fan delicately over my décolletage.
We could...
His eyes flicked up, assessing our surroundings for possible prospects of seclusion, then down again, ineluctably drawn to the fan as though it were a magnet. "No, we couldn't," I informed him, smiling, and bowing to the elderly Mrs. McNeil who was strolling past behind him. "Every nook and cranny in the house is filled with people. So are the barns and stables and outbuildings. And if you had in mind a rendezvous under a bush on the river bank, think again. This dress cost a bloody fortune." A fortune in illegal whiskey, but a fortune nonetheless.
"Oh, I ken that well enough."
His eyes travelled slowly over me, from the coils of upswept hair to the tips of my new calf-leather shoes. The dress was pale amber silk, bodice and hem embroidered with silk leaves in shades of brown and gold, and if I did say so myself, it fit me like a glove.
"Worth it,"
he said softly, and leaned down to kiss me. A chilly breeze stirred the oak branches overhead, and I moved closer to him, seeking his warmth.
What with the long journey from the ridge and the crush of guests caused by the impending celebration, we hadn't shared a bed ourselves in more than a week. It wasn't so much an amorous encounter I wanted, though I would certainly not say no if the opportunity offered. What I missed was simply the feel of his body next to mine, being able to reach out a hand in the dark and rest it on the long swell of his thigh, to roll toward him in the morning and cup his round, neat buttocks in the curve of thigh and belly, to press my cheek against his back and breathe the scent of his skin as I slipped into sleep. "Damn," I said, resting my forehead briefly in the folds of his shirt ruffle and inhaling the mingled scents of starch and man with longing.
"You know, if your aunt and Duncan don't need the bed, perhaps..."
"Ooh, so you were wondering."
"No, I wasn't," I said. "Besides, what business is it of yours?"
"Oh, none at all," he said, unperturbed. "Only I've been asked by four men this morning if I think they will, or have done already. Which is rather a compliment to my aunt, no?"
It was true. Jocasta Mackenzie must be well into her 60s, and yet the thought of her sharing a man's bed was by no means unthinkable.
I had met any number of women who had gratefully abandoned all notion of sex, directly the cessation of childbearing made it possible, but Jocasta wasn't one of them.
At the same time...
"They haven't," I said. "Phedre told me yesterday." "I know. Duncan told me just now."
He was frowning slightly, but not at me. Toward the terrace, where the bright splotch of Duncan's tartan showed between the huge stone vases.
"Did he?" I was more than a little surprised at that.
A sudden suspicion struck me.
"You didn't ask him, did you?"
He gave me a slightly reproachful look.
"I did not," he said. "What do you take me for, Sassenach?" "A Scot," I said. "Sex fiends, the lot of you. Or so one would think, listening to all the talk around here."
I gave Farquhar Campbell a hard look, but he had turned his back, engrossed in conversation. Jamie regarded me thoughtfully, scratching the corner of his jaw.
Sex fiends?
You know what I mean.
Oh, aye, I do. I'm only wondering, is that an insult, would you say? Or a compliment?
I opened my mouth, then paused. I gave him back the thoughtful look. If the shoe fits, I said, wear it. He burst out laughing, which made a number of those nearby turn and look at us. Taking my arm, he steered me across the lawn and into the patchy shade of the elms.
I did mean to ask you something, Sassenach, he said, checking over his shoulder to be sure we were out of earshot. Can you find occasion to speak with my aunt alone?
In this madhouse? I glanced toward the terrace. A swarm of well-wishers surrounded Duncan like bees round a flower patch. Yes, I suppose I could catch her in her room before she comes down for the wedding. She's gone up to rest.
I wouldn't mind a lie down either. My legs ached with hours of standing, and my shoes were new and slightly too tight. That'll do.
He nodded pleasantly to an approaching acquaintance, then turned his back, shielding us from interruption. All right, I said. Why?
Well, it's to do with Duncan.
He looked at once amused and slightly worried.
There's a wee difficulty, and he cannot bring himself to speak to her about it.
Don't tell me, I said. He was married before, and he thought his first wife was dead, but he's just seen her here, eating Cullen skink.
Well, no, he said, smiling. Not so bad as that. And perhaps it's nae so troublesome as Duncan fears. But he's worried in his mind about it, and yet he cannot bring himself to speak to my aunt.
He's a bit shy of her, aye?
Duncan was a shy and modest man altogether. An ex-fisherman pressed into service during the Rising, he had been captured after Culloden and spent years in prison. He had been released, rather than transported, only because he'd contracted blood poisoning from a scratch and had lost one arm, making him unfit for labour and unsaleable as an indenture. I didn't have to wonder whose idea this marriage had been. Such lofty aspirations would never have occurred to Duncan in a million years.
I can see that. What's he worried about, though?
Well, he said slowly, it's true that Duncan hasn't been wed before. Did you not wonder why?
No, I said. I just assumed that the Rising had... Oh, dear.
I stopped, catching a notion of what this might be about. It's not...
Goodness! You mean he likes men?
My voice rose involuntarily.
No,
he said, scandalized. Christ, you didn't think I'd let him marry my aunt and him a sodomite. Christ!
He glanced around to be sure no one had heard this calumny and shepherded me into the shelter of the trees just in case.
Well, you wouldn't necessarily know, would you? I asked, amused.
I'd know, he said grimly. Come along.
He lifted an overhanging bough and ushered me beneath it, a hand in the small of my back. The grove was a large one, and it was easy enough to get out of sight of the party.
No,
he said again, reaching a small open space well in among the trunks.
A filthy mind of you, Sassenach. No, it's nothing of the sort.
He glanced behind him, but we were a good distance from the lawn and reasonably shielded from view.
It's only that he's... incapable.
He lifted one shoulder slightly, looking profoundly uncomfortable at the thought.
What? Impotent?
I felt my mouth hanging open and closed it.
Aye. He was betrothed as a young man, but there was a dreadful accident. A cart horse knocked him into the street and kicked him in the scrotum.
He made a slight motion as though to touch himself for reassurance, but checked it.
He healed, but it... Well, he wasn't a fit for nuptial rites any longer. So he released the young woman, and she married elsewhere.
The poor man, I said, with a pang of sympathy. Gracious! Poor Duncan's had nothing but bad luck.
Well, he's alive, Jamie observed. A good many others aren't. Besides...
He gestured over one shoulder at the spread of River Run behind him.
I shouldn't be inclined to call his present situation precisely unlucky. Bar the one small difficulty, that is, he added.
I frowned, running through the medical possibilities. If the accident had resulted in severe vascular damage, there wasn't much I could do. I was in no way equipped for fine reconstructive surgery. If it were only a hemiseal, though, then perhaps... When he was a young man, you said?
Well, it's not promising after so long, but I can certainly have a look and see whether...
Jamie stared at me, incredulous.
A look? Sassenach, the man goes puce when you inquire after the health of his bowels, and he nearly died of shame telling me. He'll have an apoplexy and you go poking his privates.
A strand of hair had been pulled loose by an oak twig. I pushed it irritably behind my ear.
Well, what did you expect me to do then? I can't heal him with spell casting.
Of course not, he said, a little impatiently. I didn't want you to do anything to Duncan. Only to speak to my aunt.
What? You mean she doesn't know?
But they've been engaged to be married for months, and living together for most of it. Aye, but...
Jamie made the odd half-shrugging gesture he used when feeling embarrassed or uncomfortable, as though his shirt were too tight.
Do you see, when the question of marriage rose, it never occurred to Duncan that it was a matter of...
I said, raising one eyebrow. Doesn't marriage usually involve at least the possibility of...
Well, he didn't think my aunt was wanting him for his manly beauty, eh?
Jamie said, raising his own brows back at me.
It seemed only a matter of business and convenience. There are things he could manage as owner of River Run that he couldn't do as an overseer. At that, he wouldn't have agreed, save she persuaded him.
And he never thought to mention this impediment?
Oh, he thought. But there wasn't any indication that my aunt regarded marriage in any but the sense of business. She didn't mention the matter of bed. He was too shy to say. And the question didn't really arise, Ken.
I gather that it now has arisen.
What happened? Did your aunt slip her hand under his kilt this morning and make a bawdy remark about the wedding night?
It didn't happen to say, he replied dryly. But it wasn't until this morning, when he began to hear the jests among the guests, that it occurred to Duncan that perhaps my aunt was expecting him to... Well.
He lifted one shoulder and let it fall.
He couldn't think what to do, and was in a panic, listening to everyone.
I see. I rubbed a knuckle across my upper lip, thinking, poor Duncan. No wonder he's been nervous.
Aye.
Jamie straightened up with the air of one having settled something.
So, if you'll be so kind as to speak with Jocasta and see it's all straight.
Me? You want me to tell her?
Well, I shouldn't think she'll mind greatly, he said, looking quizzically down at me. After all, at her age, I shouldn't think...
I made a rude noise.
Her age? Your grandfather Simon was well into his 70s and still putting it about when last seen.
My aunt is a woman, he said rather austerely, if you hadn't noticed it.
And you think that makes a difference?
You don't.
Oh, makes a difference, all right, I said.
I leaned back against a tree, arms crossed under my bosom, and gave him a look from under my lashes.
When I am 101 and you're 96... I'll invite you to my bed, and we'll see which one of us rises to the occasion,
He looked at me thoughtfully, a glint in the dark blue of his eyes.
Never mind to take you where you stand, Sassenach, he said. Payment on account,
Never mind to take you up on it, I said. However...
I glanced through the screen of branches toward the house, which was clearly visible. The trees were beginning to leaf out, but the tiny sprays of tender green were by no means sufficient camouflage. I turned back, just as Jamie's hands descended on the swell of my hips. Events after that were somewhat confused, with the predominant impression being an urgent rustling of fabric, the sharp scent of trodden onion grass, and the crackling of last year's oak leaves, dry underfoot. My eyes popped open a few moments later.
"Don't stop," I said, disbelieving. "Not now, for God's sake."
He grinned down at me, stepping back and letting his kilt fall into place. His face was flushed, a ruddy bronze with effort, and his chest heaved under his shirt ruffles. He grinned maliciously and wiped a sleeve across his forehead.
"I'll give you the rest when I'm 96, I..."
"You won't live that long. Come here."
"Oh," he said. "So you'll speak to my aunt?"
"Effing blackmailer," I panted, fumbling at the folds of his kilt. "I'll get you for this, I swear I will."
"Oh, aye, you will."
He put an arm round my waist and swung me off my feet, turning round so that his back was to the house, screening me with his body. His long fingers deftly ruffled up the skirt of my gown, then the two petticoats beneath, and even more deftly slid between my bare legs.
"Hush," he murmured in my ear. "Your dinner won't folk to hear, do you?"
He set his teeth gently in the curve of my ear and proceeded about his business in a workmanlike way, ignoring my intermittent and admittedly rather feeble struggles. I was more than ready, and he knew what he was doing. It didn't take long. I dug my fingers into his arm, hard as an iron bar across my middle, arched backward for a moment of dizzying infinity, then collapsed against him, twitching like a worm on the end of a hook. He made a deep chuckling sound and let go of my ear. A cold breeze had sprung up and was wafting the folds of my skirts about my legs. The scent of smoke and food drifted through the cool spring air, along with the rumble of talk and laughter from the lawn. I could dimly hear it under the slow, loud thumping of my heart.
"Come to think of it," Jamie remarked, releasing me, "Duncan has still got the one good hand."
He set me gently on my feet, keeping hold of my elbow, lest my knees give way.
"You might mention that to my aunt, if you think it will help."
Chapter 41. Music Hath Charms. Roger Mackenzie made his way through the crowd, nodding here and there to a familiar face, but pushing on purposefully, preventing any attempt at conversation. He was not in a talkative mood. Brianna had gone off to feed the kid, and while he missed her, he was just as pleased that she was out of sight for the moment. He didn't care at all for the sort of looks she'd been getting. Those directed at her face were admiring, but respectful enough. He'd caught that wee bastard Forbes staring at her rear view with an expression similar to the one the gentlemen were using on the undraped marble goddess on the lawn, though. At the same time, he was more than proud of her. She was gorgeous in her new dress, and he felt a pleasant sense of possession when he looked at her. Still, his pleasure was slightly spoiled by the uneasy thought that she looked as though she belonged here. Mistress of all this. Yet another slave trotted past him, skirts hooped up over one arm as she made for the house, a basin of fresh rolls balanced on her head, and another under her arm. "How many slaves did Jocasta Cameron keep?" he wondered. Of course, that alone put the notion of Brianna's inheriting River Run out of the question. She wouldn't countenance the notion of slaves, not ever. Nor would he himself. Still, it was comforting to think that it wasn't merely his own pride keeping Bree from her rightful inheritance. He caught the thin wail of a fiddle coming from the house and felt his ears prick up at the sound. Of course there would be music for the party, and with luck, a few new songs that he didn't know. He turned across the terrace toward the house. He hadn't a notebook with him, but doubtless Ulysses could provide him with something. He bowed to Mrs. Farquhar Campbell, who looked like a particularly horrible but expensive lampshade in pink silk. He paused to let her precede him into the house, biting the inside of his cheek as the 4-foot spread of her skirt stuck momentarily in the 3-foot doorway. She twitched adroitly sideways, though, and sidled crabwise into the hall, Roger following at a respectful distance. The fiddle had ceased, but he could hear the twang and throb of instruments being handled and tuned nearby. They were in the big drawing room, whose double doors could be thrown open to allow dancers to spill out across the foyer when the time came. At the moment, there were only a few guests in the drawing room, engaged in casual conversation. Roger made his way past Ulysses, who was standing at the hearth, immaculate in wig and green livery, a poker held at the ready as he supervised two maidservants in the making of a gigantic vat of fresh rum punch. His eyes flicked automatically to the door, registered Roger's presence and identity, then returned to his business. The musicians were huddled at the far end of the room, casting occasional thirsty glances at the hearth as they readied their instruments.
"What will you be giving us, the D?"
Roger inquired, pausing beside the fiddler. He smiled as the man turned round to him.
"Yui with the crooked horn, perhaps, or Sean Bui?" "Oh, God love you, sir, nothing fancy."
The conductor of the small ensemble, a cricket-like Irishman whose bent back was belied by the brightness of his eyes, waved a hand in cordial scorn at his motley crew of musicians.
"They ain't up to more than jigs and reels. No more of the folk as will be dancing, though," he added practically. "'Tisn't the assembly rooms in Dublin, after all, nor even Edenton. A good fiddler can keep 'em up to snuff." "And that would be you, I expect,"
Roger said with a smile, nodding at the cracked fiddle case the conductor had set on a whatnot, carefully out of the way of being stepped or sat on.
"That would be me," the gentleman agreed, with a graceful bow of acknowledgement. "Seamus Hanlon, sir, your servant."
"I'm obliged, sir. Roger Mackenzie of Fraser's Ridge."
He returned the bow, taking pleasure in the old-fashioned formality, and clasped Hanlon's hand briefly, careful of the twisted fingers and knobby joints. Hanlon saw his care of the arthritic hand and gave a brief grimace of deprecation.
"Ah, they'll be fine with a drop of lubrication, so they will."
Hanlon flexed one hand experimentally, then flipped the fingers in dismissal, fixing Roger with a bright glance.
"And yourself, sir? I felt the calluses on your fingertips. Not a fiddler, perhaps, but would you be after playing some stringed instrument?"
"Only to pass the time of an evening. Nothing like you gentlemen."
Roger nodded politely toward the ensemble, which, now unpacked, boasted a battered cello, two viols, a trumpet, a flute, and something which he thought might have started life as a hunting horn, though it appeared to have been amended since by the addition of several odd loops of tubing that stuck out in different directions. Hanlon eyed him shrewdly, taking in his breadth of chest.
"And hark at the voice in him. Sure, and you're a singer, Mr. Mackenzie."
Roger's reply was interrupted by a loud thump and a dolorous twang behind him. He whirled to see the cello player inflating himself over his instrument in the manner of a hen with a very large chick, to protect it from further injury by the gentleman who had evidently kicked it carelessly in passing.
"Watch yourself, then," the cellist snapped. "Clumsy sot."
"Oh?"
The intruder, a stocky man in naval uniform, glowered menacingly at the cellist.
"You dare speak to me?"
His face was flushed an unhealthy red, and he swayed slightly as he stood.
Roger could smell the fumes of alcohol from a distance of 6 feet.
The officer raised a forefinger to the cellist and appeared to be on the point of speech. A tongue-tip showed pinkly between his teeth, but no words emerged. His empurpled jowls quivered for a moment, then he abandoned the attempt, turned on his heel, and made off, swerving narrowly to avoid the incoming footman with a tray of drinks and caroming off the door jamb as he passed into the corridor.
"Where then, Mr. O'Reilly?"
Seamus Hanlon spoke dryly to the cellist.
"Were we near the sea? I should reckon there'd be a press gang waiting for you the instant you set foot outside. As it is, I'd put no odds on him laying for you with a marlin spike or something of the kind."
O'Reilly spat eloquently on the floor.
"I know him," he said contemptuously. "Wolf, he's called. Dog, more like. And a poor dog at that. He's tight as a tick. He'll not remember me an hour hence."
Hanlon squinted thoughtfully at the doorway through which the lieutenant had vanished.
"Well, that's as maybe," he allowed. "But I know the gentleman too,
and I do believe his mind might be somewhat sharper than his behaviour might suggest. He stood for a moment, tapping the bow of his fiddle thoughtfully against the palm of his hand, then turned his head toward Roger.
"Fraser's Ridge," you said. "Will you be a kinsman of Mrs. Cameron's, or Mrs. Innes, I should say?" he corrected himself.
"I'm married to Jamie Fraser's daughter," Roger said patiently, having discovered that this was the most efficient description, as most of the county appeared to know who Jamie Fraser was, and it prevented further questions regarding Roger's own family connections.
"Ho, ho," Seamus said, looking visibly impressed. "Well, then. What's that bladder doing here, anyway?"
the cellist demanded, still glaring after the departed officer.
He patted his instrument soothingly.
"Everyone knows he meant to wed Mrs. Cameron and have River run for himself. I wonder he's the tripes to show his face today."
"Perhaps he's come to show there are no hard feelings," Roger suggested.
"A civil gesture. Best man won and all that, aye?"
The musicians emitted a medley of sniggers and guffaws at this suggestion.
"Maybe," said the flutist, shaking his head over his instrument. "But if you're any friend to Duncan Innes, tell him to watch his back in the dancing." "Aye, do that," Seamus Hanlon concurred. "Be off with you, young man, and speak to him. But say you come back."
He crooked a finger at the waiting footman and scooped a cup neatly from the proffered tray. He lifted this in salute, grinning at Roger over its rim.
"It may be you'll know a tune or two that's new to me."
Chapter 42. The Dessal Charm. Brianna sat back in the leather wing chair before the hearth, nursing Jemmy as she watched her great-aunt ready herself for the wedding.
"What do you think, then?" Fedra asked, dipping the silver comb into a small pot of pomade. "Dress it up high with a curl over the top?"
Her voice was hopeful but wary. She disapproved overtly of her mistress's refusal to wear a wig, and would do her level best to create a similarly fashionable effect with Jocasta's own hair, if allowed.
"Tosh," said Jocasta. "This isn't Edinburgh, child, let alone London."
She leaned back, head lifted and eyes closed, basking. Bright spring sunshine poured through the panes, sparking off the silver comb and making dark shadows of the slave's hands against the nimbus of shining white hair.
"Maybe not, but take the wild Caribbean nor the back country neither," Fedra countered. "You be the mistress here, this your wedding. Everyone be looking at you. You want to shame me, wear your hair down your shoulders like a squaw, and everybody be thinking I don't know my business?"
"Oh, heaven forbid."
Jocasta's wide mouth twisted with an irritable humour.
"Dress it simply, if you please. Swept back and put up with combs. Perhaps my niece will let you show off your skill on her locks."
Fedra cast a narrow glance over her shoulder at Brianna, who simply smiled and shook her head. She'd worn a lace-edged cap for the sake of public decency, and wasn't disposed to fuss with her hair. The slave snorted and resumed her attempt to cajole Jocasta. Brianna closed her eyes, letting the amicable bickering recede into the background. Warm sun fell through the casement over her feet, and the fire purred and crackled at her back, embracing her like the old woolen shawl she had wrapped about herself and little Jem. Beyond the voices of Jocasta and Fedra, she could hear the thrum of the house below. Every room in the house was bursting with guests. Some were staying at nearby plantations and had ridden in for the festivities, but enough were staying at River Run overnight that all the bedchambers were full, with guests sleeping five and six to a bed, and more on pallets in the tents by the river landing. Brianna eyed the expanse of Jocasta's big tester bed enviously. Between the exigencies of travel, Jemmy, and the crowded conditions at River Run, she and Roger hadn't slept together in more than a week, and weren't likely to until they'd returned to the ridge. Not that sleeping together was the major concern, nice as it was. The tug of the baby's mouth on her breast aroused a number of non-maternal urges elsewhere, which required both Roger and a little privacy for satisfaction. They had started something promising the night before, in the pantry, but had been interrupted by one of the kitchen slaves coming in to fetch a cheese.
Perhaps the stable.
She stretched her legs out, toes curling, and wondered whether the groom slept in the stable or not.
"Well, I shall wear the brilliance then, but only to please you, Anian,"